White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the July 22nd, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour, coming to you live from the White Network. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me here in the first hour is William Fink, who runs the website christagenia.org. And he has his own radio programs on Friday and Saturday evenings from that site and on TalkShoe. We're going to be discussing the civil rights aspect of the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman affair and basically how the black or Negro or African American community, however you want to call it, cannot and will not understand law and justice as it relates to themselves. Hello, Bill Fink, and welcome to the Heretics Hour.
Hello, thank you for having me, and praise Christ.
All right, and you know, this is about the, I didn't go back and count them, but this is at least the fifth or sixth time you've been on the Heretics Hour, maybe more than that, so, but it has been a while.
So I'm glad. It's probably been a year, I guess. I've been tied up.
I know, you're real busy, but I'm glad that you're here tonight. I'm glad we found a good topic that we could that we could do together. And I know you have some special information about how the United States Justice Department handles civil federal rights cases, and some of these black people are hoping that such will be brought against Zimmerman. Fat chance of that, I think. But first, we've got some other things to go into before that, maybe, or are you going to tie that in together with looking at some of the where the civil rights problems are, and you were telling me you think they're with the media.
Well, absolutely. I'd like to make the statement that, you know, I don't care one whit about Zimmerman. He's not white, so I don't care about him, and that's why I don't care about him. And that might sound cold to some people, but that's the cold, hard truth. Mm-hmm. And just to clear that air, because I don't want people getting confused and I'm concerned for Zimmerman himself. Civil rights cases, the Civil Rights Act is a criminal act as far as I'm concerned. The whole thing's unconstitutional. It's evil. It's wicked. It's done our people a lot of harm. It's basically, in many ways, it's harmed, law enforcement in this country, because law enforcement officers are deathly afraid of civil rights cases. You can't win a civil rights case. I know, because I'm the victim of the Civil Rights Act. I consider myself a victim of the criminal Civil Rights Act, right? That the when you beat a state case like Zimmerman did, he beat the state case, and now the government has the ability to sit down and look at that case basically from a political viewpoint and decide on whether they want to bring a civil action against you in a civil rights case. And now, even though it's cloaked as a civil action, the penalties are criminal. So it's really double indemnity. And I didn't beat my state case, but my state charges against me in 1993 were dismissed. That they were actually dismissed in 1994, and the federal government went immediately and got an indictment and indicted me and some of my co-defendants for a civil rights violation. And when you're brought into court, federal court, for a civil rights violation, the rules of evidence, the judge has broad latitude over the rules of evidence. Basically, all of the evidence that caused the state prosecutors to move to dismiss my case, all of that evidence was barred in federal court. I couldn't bring any of it. They don't care. They make blanket rulings like that, and they challenge you to challenge them. And you can challenge them if you're very wealthy and can afford a lot of lawyers. If you're not very wealthy, you're basically screwed. That's the way it is. That now, because it's a civil case, they do not need to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And they do not need 12 jurors. They do not need a unanimous jury to find you guilty. They could find you guilty. I forget exactly what the number is. I think it's 8 or 9 jurors can find you guilty and you lose the case. And it's not, the standard of proof is not required to be beyond a reasonable doubt. They could just feel that you're culpable and vote against you.
Well, I don't know if you can explain to us real quick, easily, how it is that they can have different rules for their federal
because it's cases. Civil court rules. It's civil court rules, as if like okay. you're filing a lawsuit against
okay.
me.
So you said it was civil, even though they have criminal penalties.
And it's criminal penalties, right. Yeah. You can go to prison for a long time. Zimmerman can go to prison for possibly second-degree murder, and he can go to prison for maybe up to 16, 18 years for that.
Mm-hmm.
As
wow.
a civil penalty, right? And then when he gets out of prison, he has no civil rights himself.
Yeah.
He can't vote. He can't vote in many states. He can't, bear firearms again and whatever else that they strip you of. And that's it. He's lost his own civil rights. And that's evil also. The entire Civil Rights Act is a very evil act. It really is because it's impossible. The way the rules of evidence are geared, it's practically impossible to beat the government. I don't know if anybody's ever won a civil rights case. I don't know. But I've never heard of anybody winning a civil rights case. I don't keep track of it, right?
There's a lawyer, Don, who has been on my program a couple times, and he keeps in touch and everything. And he's got this theory he's been working on, and he wrote me about it not long ago. We started out with this slavery of blacks, and then when they overturned that and did all this legal stuff and then came up with the civil rights, he says it's turned into slavery of whites under the heel of the blacks. It's turned itself around totally. What do you say to that?
Well, it has, because civil rights cases, there might be instances out there, but I personally don't know of any time when a racial minority has been brought up on federal civil rights charges. I don't know. I've never heard of it. As far as I've seen, those charges are only brought about against whites, and especially white law enforcement officers and white youths who are involved in gang activity. I've seen that, right? I have seen that in New Jersey in the 80s and 90s. White youths involved in gang activity, white law enforcement officers, I've seen them charged with civil rights offenses. I've never seen a Negro or a mestizo, meaning a Latino or a Hispanic. I'd rather prefer to call them mestizos. I've never seen them brought up on federal civil rights charges.
Yeah, well, I guess they're not. I mean, that's the whole thing, that these laws are against whites only, and they don't even consider that they apply to what they call minorities.
Now, I might be wrong also, but I don't recall a case where a white cop was brought up on civil rights charges when the victim was white.
Mm-hmm.
Only when the victim's a minority. That's all I've seen. That's my personal experience. I don't have time to research all the cases. I tried to do a few searches leading into this program, and I didn't really come up with anything that would refute what I'm saying, but I could be wrong, but I've never seen a time when it was a white victim and civil rights charges brought. Never. Not even against
so.
A black cop. I've never seen it.
Yeah, well, that's what I read. I mean, that's what's written. Is that it's, we know that it's only, we know how many, black on white crimes are committed all the time, and they're not considered hate crimes, and they're not considered, they wouldn't come under the heading depriving somebody of their civil rights either.
Well, the media downplays black on white crime. Black on white crime is rarely, given constant national attention in the media, like the rare cases of white on black crime are.
Right.
And Zimmerman, even if Zimmerman were white, you know, the very same week that Trayvon Martin was shot, four Negroes abducted two white men in Memphis, Tennessee, robbed them and raped them and stabbed them, and it was not national media. I'm sure you probably never heard the case. It was not national media attention. It didn't get any media attention. Mm-hmm. Four black males, all they were all importees, supposed refugees from Sudan or Kenya or someplace like that. It's on my Saxon Messenger website. This is in Nashville, Tennessee. It was March 19th, 2012, just a few weeks after the Trayvon Martin incident. And they had names like Tut Tut, age 15, Dual Wall, age 21. They abducted two white men. They forced them to empty out their bank accounts with their debit cards. They robbed them and they raped them and they stabbed them.
And they always insist that it's not a racial crime. It's not because of their race. And if they do take money, then they can say, well, they did it for money, which is somehow okay. Not okay to attack someone over race, but it's okay to attack them just to rob them, which doesn't make sense.
Well, the media portrayed Zimmerman as white, and he's anything but white. He's a Hispanic, he's a mestizo, he's a Latino, whatever you want to call him. I don't care that he's half white. The media calls Barack Obama black. So Zimmerman, regardless of his last name, he's not white. He's a Latino. If we're going to use the same standards.
Yeah.
The media.
And he calls himself that, but, they wanted to portray him as white as possible, because they wanted a white on black crime.
Well, right. And because they need white on black crimes, to show that whites are an oppressive majority and because it fits their liberal agenda very well. Yet, a few weeks after the Trayvon Martin incident, a 50-year-old man in the same area in Florida was pulled out of his SUV by Negro youths and beat practically to death with a hammer. And he was in it. What did he do?
Yeah.
And that was a response to the Trayvon Martin innocent and the Trayvon Martin incident and the way the media portrayed that incident. Why isn't the national media? Why aren't some of those reporters that made those reports that showed those pictures of a 12-year-old baby Trayvon Martin and calling George Zimmerman his shooter white? Why aren't some of those people brought up on civil rights charges? Basically, they're committing pandering to murder. They're committing pandering to commit murder. That's a crime. And they're committing that. They're pandering to commit murder. The same thing with the Matthew Owens case. Matthew Owens, what was beaten, and it was openly Negro reprisals for Trayvon Martin. And it basically the media incited the beating of Matthew Owens. The media incited the beating of the unnamed 50-year-old that was pulled out of his SUV. The flash mobs that happened, in Miami, Florida, that there were flash mobs immediately after the media reporting of the Trayvon Martin incident. So the media incited black youths, I guess, to go steal big screen TVs as retribution for Trayvon Martin.
The fact that some of these people, there have been deaths in these, protests and riots and so on and just isolated incidents like you're mentioning, isolated incidents where white people have actually been killed, by blacks who say this is for Trayvon Martin or been beaten up real bad. And this is, I guess you can find it, but nobody makes anything out about it. And yet they go on and on about this Trayvon Martin. You're right. I mean, there's nobody with any reach to talk about this and play it up. I mean, it can be talked about, but not with any to reach the majority of the people, like in the mainstream media. And they won't do it. And I don't know. I guess it takes too much money to work up lawsuits against media companies.
The media knew, and it was reported that Trayvon Martin was a football player, that he was over 6 feet tall, the media knew that Zimmerman was a pudgy 5'9" middle-aged man. The
well, he's 29. He's 29, Bill. Now he's not middle-aged, but
well, he's a lot older. He's 10 years older than Trayvon Martin, right?
Right.
10, 12 years older. That the media. I have a report, a video on Christogenia.org, and it's the only video I put up of the reporting the Trayvon Martin incident. But it's very clear. It's from Fox News, Fox 35, Seminole County, Florida. It's a video from a news report made the day after the Martin shooting. And the video portrays Martin as a big man who was on top of Zimmerman and beating on him when he was shot. The news reporter interviewed one of the people who lived in the immediate vicinity who witnessed the shooting of Martin. And that was the report. Now, the national news media ignored that entire report. They ignored that entire report. They purposely depicted Zimmerman as white. That they purposely depicted Martin as a 12-year-old. They published his picture from when he was like 12 years old. They purposely depicted him as a helpless little black boy and as a total complete victim in the shooting. Even though the local news media did broadcast the truth as we know it now after a lengthy trial.
Well, you know, I looked at that video and everybody should look at that video, and it was done, yeah, right there in in the county or whatever the news service is there, the local news, and it was, the reporter was there the next morning, early in the morning, and that thing, you know, he did talk to that resident behind his closed door, and the resident said very clearly what, you know, that the guy who was calling for help, he thought was in a red sweater or something. But he went up to his apartment or upstairs to call 911. He was afraid to be involved in it. And then he looked out the window again, and he saw the person who had been on top beating up the guy on the bottom who was calling for help was laying there dead. He didn't mention race. You know, they didn't ask him. People know, I guess, that particularly if you live in Florida, that you shouldn't do that. But it was clear what he said, and you're right, then what happened to that? I mean, that was Fox News, a local subsidiary, I guess, and I suppose that was entered into evidence in the trial by the defense.
Well, this original news report fully reflects the outcome of the trial.
Yeah.
You know, the outcome of the trial is exactly what the news report said that, yeah, you know, how this news report characterized the case.
Right. And it was the very next morning, so it was, nobody was trying to, you know, set something up or lie or make some, you know, make up some story.
Well,
but
right.
You're right. The question is how does the national media immediately take control of this story? And they must have something set up already that when it's a white on black, or a black on white.
Well,
how does this proceed?
These local news outlets report to Associated Press, United Press International, but whatever press agencies they belong to that they're members of, that's how those press agencies get those reports and distribute them nationwide. So I mean, I'm sure that the national news media picked these reports up out of the local news media, out of those press associations, and must have, that they had to miss somewhere. This entire case was mischaracterized, and because it was mischaracterized, it incited these Negroes to riot or to do violent things and kill other innocent white people.
Yeah,
and there's no one's held responsible for that.
Right.
There's absolute culpability on the part of the media, on the part of the national media, or the reporting associations, the news associations. One or the other is responsible. There's no way around that. And nobody's held responsible. That is what that these government prosecutors should be forced to look into. That's what they should be investigating rather than weighing whether or not Zimmerman should go to trial for a civil rights violation.
Yeah, and this stupid attorney general, boy, you know, he still hasn't even come right out and said, well, we're not going to do it because we don't have any grounds. He's letting it just people just kind of slowly take it in, you know, because he doesn't want to face the anger of his black constituency there. But he knows that he knew months ago that there was no grounds for a federal civil rights action.
Well, right, but they will try to find grounds. They'll probably grill Zimmerman. I've been there. I've been through it. They look for grounds. They try to,
You mean they can call him in and interrogate him and so on? And
absolutely. They could try to discover his motives and that they could try what they'll try to do. And I've been through this. What they will try to do is they will try to investigate whether or not they can characterize his motives and portray them as if he had a racial agenda or a particular bias against this black youth.
Well, how did they do that with you, Bill, if you don't mind saying something about it? So obviously that's what they did with you. They were questioning you and they were trying to find, you know, some grounds for you to have a racial bias.
Well, they did that and they had a whole line of questioning for me and I had answers that refuted that.
Yeah, so
I don't like to admit it, but I took Spanish for several years in school. That the alleged victim in my case was Spanish. I can speak, not fluent Spanish, but I could speak Spanish at that time well enough to convince people that I could speak fluent Spanish. And I had some Hispanic associates on the law enforcement department I worked for. So I was able to shirk the charge of racist at the time. I couldn't do it now, but I was able to do it then.
No, you couldn't now because of your record. What did they get you on then if it wasn't racial?
Well, it's under color of law, right? It's under color of law. They would like to be able to add the charge of racism to that, right? But it's under color of law. That's all they need.
Okay. Color of law.
Being in law enforcement, that's all they need.
You were in law enforcement. Okay. Under cover of law, okay.
Under color of law.
Oh, color.
It's a legal term, right?
All right. I get it. Well, so that you think they're still going to go, you think the holder will still go after,
Well, he will if he can make a case that Zimmerman pursued Trayvon Martin because he was black. And that's probably what they're investigating. From my experience, I would say that's what they're investigating.
Yeah. But they've already investigated and they've said that they had, they interviewed 30 people back when this after this happened, because Zimmerman had not been charged by the state. So they were, you know, looking into doing this. And they had FBI people interviewing 30 people, didn't find a single case, a single person who would back that up, say that, you know, could provide anything for, they have some stories about him and how he is very non-racially,
Right, and I'm sure they're going to weigh all that, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have all the details that you do in the aftermath of the case. I really don't follow the mainstream news. But I know what I know from my personal experience, right? I know how they'll approach it and how they'll try to or look at bringing him up on civil rights charges. Now, what you're saying is true, that then that would make their case look very bad.
Yeah, I don't think they'll end up bringing one, but they're trying to get their black people to settle down maybe or to be able to take it. Now, this brings us to this mentality of blacks, you know, and I'd really rather call them Africans. To me, more and more, they're just like people in Africa. And they're here in this country acting like Africans and being like Africans. And they're never, ever going to fit in with white Europeans. Never, ever. Because of the because of the difference in IQ first. You know, you can't bring people with such a huge difference in IQ together. Now, I know there's a lot of blacks that have a lot of white blood. They're half or maybe even three quarters white. Some of them, they're the ones who often do the best, except for people in sports and entertainment. But that's about the only area that they can excel, and that's because the Jews took over these sports and entertainment and brought, you know, turned it into something that is that, you know, is more conducive for black people than for white people to be.
Well, organized sports. It can be demonstrated that organized sports is clearly biased against whites and promotes Negroes on purpose. They purposely promote Negroes, and there are many cases which have been documented. I don't have any offhand, but there's a gentleman out in Nevada that has actually done a lot of work in this area. He's demonstrated many cases of athletes, white athletes, who are as good or superior to, with records, with their college records, black athletes who did not get jobs in professional sports or did not get the better jobs in professional sports simply because they were white. It does happen. There are exceptions in certain positions, like baseball pitcher and football quarterback, but it can be documented that white running backs, white linebackers didn't get jobs, didn't get better contract offers, didn't get spots on the better teams simply because they were white. That there is a clear bias.
Well, you know, we know that it's shameful that all these white men and boys and so on and some women they should have given up sports watching when it turned black like it has, but they don't. They cheer for these sport teams that are black, just like, and they do the same in Europe for their soccer teams when they get all those blacks on it. You know, this is so easily if we people, white people, would be racially.
I don't know how many white nationalists I've encountered, and even Christian identity white nationalists. Where to me, sports isn't only, you know, that their methods, the methods of organized sports are clearly contrary to white nationalism. But if you're a Christian white nationalist, you certainly shouldn't be engaged in the worship, the watching of organized sports. And that's my theological opinion. However, the point I'm trying to make is that even with that, I've seen many people in Christian identity and in secular white nationalists, if I have to use that term, who justify and rationalize engaging and watching in these professional sporting events and giving their money to that, when basically they're absolutely contrary to the interest of our race. There's no doubt. I wouldn't give a dime. I don't drink Coke, and I wouldn't pay for a Coke because of the money that Coke gives to professional sports through advertising and the promotion of that. And that's true of all the brands that I consume. I don't, if they engage in that sort of that the endorsements and the advertising, I avoid those brands. I don't support them. I wouldn't go to a sporting event. I wouldn't give you a dime to go to a sporting event. Yet you could send me to the Super Bowl, tell me it's going to cost me $1, I'll turn it down. I wouldn't go to the Super Bowl anyway, but that the, and whites, that they rationalize why they should watch that. And I tell white men all the time, you know, you watch the NFL for 20 years while your daughter's growing up. How can you tell her that, you know, when she brings Leroy home, how could you tell her that she can't date Leroy? Well, what if she says, but dad, you've been watching Leroy's on TV for 20 years. I just brought one of your heroes home. How could you tell her she can't date Leroy? You can't tell her that. You've been watching him on TV.
Yeah. Well, they also enrich them and just increase their power. So we've got a kind of a far more powerful black movement, I guess, than it used to be. I mean, it's always been pretty strong because it was supported by the Jews. Jews were behind it and Jewish lobby and so on.
Well, they still are.
Now they have all these wealthy celebrities, wealthy black celebrities with lots of money.
And they've all been created by Jews.
Yeah, they
have. Hollywood Jews or professional sports Jews, they've all been created by Jews. Oprah's been created by Jews.
Yeah.
She'd never admit it, but she was. And they all have. Bill Cosby, no matter what Negro you want to look at in the prominent position that he's in, he's really not there because he earned it, because he had to do it from scratch. He's there because he was black and the Jews wanted to create that world, and that's where we're at.
Yeah, and they give them all kinds of passes and excuses for their bad behavior and so on. But what was I going to say there?
Well, I agree with this. I agree with Anthea Butler. She didn't like the Zimmerman verdict, and she's putting the blame on a god that's white and racist. I would agree with her.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about some of this demagoguery. I wanted to do that. You know, I've got, you know, of course there's Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, but then there's this Valerie Houston also, who I don't know who she is, but she denounced everything. She's from Sanford, Florida, and says the racism and injustice that pollute the air in America. You know, they go on and on about this, how terribly they're treated, when we're just pointing out how well they're treated and how the civil rights laws allow them to get away with things and kill white people even, and they don't have to, you know, be accountable for it. And then we have this Anthea Butler that you just mentioned, and also Tavis Smiley has come out. He's a radio show host. And he says that President Obama needs to get tough and get out there and do something about this and talk this up. And, you know, he says, what's lacking in this moment is moral leadership. The country is begging for it. They're craving it. And Obama is not supplying the moral leadership. He says the country, he really means the black population. But it's moral, you know, they're not moral. They think they're moral. They present themselves as the moral side of this whole issue when they're totally immoral.
Well, they're absolutely immoral, but they've been getting away with murder. They've literally, Negroes have been getting away with murder. The media lets them. The law enforcement, they're browbeaten into it. They're afraid to do anything about it. The judges, I'll give you an example. In February of this year, a Negro, a rather large Negro, a high school football coach Negro, what was in Las Vegas, I believe this happened, in Nevada, and he punched a white man. The white man had his hands in his pockets in a casino. He punched the white man and killed him. And he got away with it because he claimed, it. There's no witnesses, there's no proof, he claimed the white man used a racial slur, and he got a $5,000 fine and 3 months in jail. That was his penalty for punching a white man in a Las Vegas casino and killing him. 3 months in jail and a $5,000 fine.
Well, that's a real good example, you know, compared to the Trayvon Martin thing.
Well, his name is Benjamin Gerard Hawkins, if anybody wants to look it up. Hawkins, Hawkins. The story was run by Ken Ritter of the Associated Press, February 14th, 2013.
What was his first name?
Benjamin Gerard, G-E-R-A-R-D, Hawkins, Hawkins, is the name of the Negro who committed the crime.
Yeah.
He punched this white man and killed him. Well, that would be... if a white man did that to a Negro, that would be at least manslaughter and carry a penalty in most states of at least 5 years and usually at least 7.
Well, who says that you have the right to punch somebody in the face because they use a racial slur? You know,
all it takes is one liberal judge. That's all it takes, one Jewish judge, and that's exactly what we had here, and a prosecutor that perhaps doesn't appeal the verdict. Prosecutors have rights to appeal verdicts. I don't know if, and I didn't follow up this case to see if this verdict was appealed, but somehow I think it probably wasn't. Maybe I should do a follow up on it. But the bottom line is that he punched this white man and killed him. that this white man had a family, had a job, and he punched him and killed him, and he got 3 months and a $5,000 fine.
Yeah. See, I mean, it's totally unfair, on opposite to what these blacks are saying. These blacks are saying, they're saying the craziest things. Let's finish with this Anthea Butler, because who says God is a white racist. And she says that God ain't good all the time. Sometimes God is not for us. And this just tells you right there that these blacks, as I kind of tried to put across in the very beginning, they see justice just like the Jews do as what's good for them. You know,
right, absolutely.
Everything is only, they can't see it apart from what's good for them.
Well, what whites don't understand about blacks, yet, you know, we as a liberal egalitarian society, because that's what we are. Well, mm-hmm. We're a liberal egalitarian society. And we have been for ever since the 14th Amendment, basically, and probably in the North a little before that. Well, as a liberal egalitarian society, we expect Negroes to function within that society as individual citizens with individual interests and to make their way on merit. That's what we expect of them, but it's not the reality. The reality is that Negroes are very tribal, and they think only in terms that are tribal, and they think only in terms on a societal level of what is pro-black, and they embrace it, and what is anti-black, and they attack it. That's how they think. Mm-hmm. And if whites thought like that, we wouldn't have Negroes in America.
Yeah. So they're all taking advantage of the way that we have this more objective point of view, where we can see good, bad, and various people. We don't see things in black and white colors like this.
Well, right, because we're trained not to, and we believe it. They don't believe that. They don't attend our schools. And when they do, that they only attend our schools so far as to collect a reward, because that being an Uncle Tom is profitable.
They hate our schools, except for the few. There's always some exceptions, you know. There's always some. In every race, every group, there's some people who are, you know, who you can praise. But for the most part, they hate school. They don't want to learn anything. And they destroy schools for white people. They should not, their schools should not be integrated at all. It's just destructive. That's what's wrong with our educational system. But this go ahead.
They don't belong in our schools. They don't belong in our schools at all. They don't belong in our society at all. And they can't function. They will never function as individuals in our society, and as law-abiding individuals. Ever.
On their own merit, yeah. They have to have this big government behind them, giving them all kinds of stuff, more than just giving them stuff, giving them a pass all the time, putting them in positions they haven't earned, and so on.
But let me draw a picture of that as I have in the past. I did this once in the past on one of my own programs, right? Whenever man wants to defy nature, he has to build an infrastructure to help him defy nature, right? You want to walk across the river, you have to build a bridge. You want to fly to the moon, you have to build launching pads, rocket ships, you know, all this apparatus to help you defy nature. You want to fly like a bird, you need a $10 million machine to fly like a bird, right? And you have to design this entire apparatus because you want to defy nature and you want to be a bird. So you build a huge machine, and that huge machine helps you be a bird. Well, mixing Negroes in a white society, or any two disparate racial elements together, is a defiance of nature. And you have to build a huge infrastructure in order to force it to work.
There you go.
And that's what the nanny state is. All throughout world history, every single multi-ethnic political entity has become a tyranny, because it requires a tyranny to hold the multi-ethnic political entity together, because it's not natural. It's a defiance of nature. And that tyranny becomes very expensive. Rome fell for that very reason. And today we're experiencing the same thing.
Right. Very good. I had some thought there, but I'm going to go on here until it comes back to me. But the fact that there's two men, I just do want to say that I agree with you totally that we have to, as you said, we have to go out of our way and turn ourselves inside out, destroy all kinds of things in order to make it possible for these people to be here. Oh, I know what I was going to say. That, you know, if you, even during slavery, I mean, these people have it so much better. Africans have it so much better here than they ever, ever could have had it back home in Africa. And so this idea that we did some terrible thing to them by bringing them over here, and they're saying, like, well, you owe us, you know, this Black Panther Party that I was just reading about before the show. They say, white America, we have given you 400 years to get it right, and you have still failed black people. That is really laughable. We certainly haven't failed black people, but black people fail again and again and again. And if even during slavery they were offered to go back, you know, okay, we'll put you in a decent ship and, you know, not in chains or anything and with, you know, decent accommodations and send you back to Africa, I bet you they would have said no, even when they were slaves. I don't know, but certainly since then, nobody's ever been willing to go back to Africa, even when they created that country of Liberia for them. They know where they're better off. So today, all these blacks, which started out to be so many thousands, hundreds of thousands, are now many millions of them here. They wouldn't, you know, their life here compared to what their life would have been if they hadn't been, their ancestors hadn't been brought here, is just incredible. You know, how can they be complaining?
Well, you know, blacks have been killing, raping, butchering each other in Africa since time began. I mean, look at what's going on in Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of blacks who have actually openly professed missing the colonial period because they had it better when white men ran the continent. And they understand that. The older ones understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from those few honest admissions that you occasionally find, and I have found them, and I've had blacks tell me that in person,
mm-hmm.
aside from those few honest admissions, the black only wants from the white whatever he can get. And the American Negro will not stop when he has a job, a house, and owns his own community, his own mansion, his own yacht. He won't stop there. He won't stop until he has you, your daughter, your daughter's daughter. That's what he wants. He wants everything. There's no coexistence with them. They want everything. To them, justice is getting everything that we currently have. To them, justice is the elimination of the white man. That's their only justice. And the ownership of the white man's wife or daughter. That's their only, that's how they see justice.
Yeah, and they're not smart enough, I swear to God, to look ahead and say, see how this just doesn't work out for them. You know, that they're just gonna revert back to what they always were without the white man. But they don't see it. They're too stupid, I guess. Most of them. Now there are these two black. Go ahead.
That they have a savage mentality that only cares for immediate gratification.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. They can't extrapolate into the future and see where their ideas would take them. They are not able to do that. And there's these two black ministers, who are going against the grain. One is, of course there's Manning, but there's two others, Jesse Lee Peterson, who was on a CNN interview with Piers Morgan. Oh, it was funny. And this Ken Hutcherson. But you know, they say that that the blacks are all wrong, and they admit that the average black person, that black, well, they say that being black is their problem, that they can't,
they shouldn't be expected to function in our society, they're not able to.
But here's the thing, let me get this in here and then I'll let you finish that. I just remembered it. They say that, like this Hutcherson says, blackness is the apex of victimhood, and they think we think our blackness is above truth. And then he says above Christianity, above our God, blah. He says we have to be in Jesus. You know, they use that. They have to be in Jesus, and that's their refuge. And when they leave that, then they don't understand anything. And I think both of these ministers say similar things. And what they understand is that as long as black people are Christian, and I'm talking about not your Christianity, but the traditional Christianity, and they're in the church and they're Christians, then they are like everyone else. And that's the best they can hope for, really, is that, you know, because all in Jesus, everyone is the same. Nobody is different, blah, blah, according to thinking.
None of that's true anyway.
Well, I know, but I'm saying according to their thinking. So they at least because they are probably fairly sincere Christian ministers think that that's the best place for black people, and all black people should stay there, because they know that that black people are not equal in the secular world, and they can't be. That's how I see it.
Well, the Negro Christian churches, so-called Christian churches that I've seen, because I don't believe a Negro should be or could be a Christian at all.
Yeah.
Because true Christianity is a way of life. It's not simply a way of control and worship in a church building for an hour a week. That you know, the black so-called, I can't even call them Christians. You could call them evangelicals. You could call them Pentecostals. You could call them Baptists. That's fine. The ones that I've seen have basically brought their tribal savagery mentality into their churches. And they act like tribal savages in their churches. That now, a very small minority of blacks can get along as long as they keep their savage mentality to themselves. They can get along in a white community as long as they obey the white man's law. And that is the best that we could ever expect from them. Once you get a large enough number of blacks in any community, it reverts to savagery. It's the evidence of that is written all over the streets of America. There should be no doubt by now that once you get, no matter how good you educate them, no matter how well you educate them, you get enough of them together in one place and they become the majority, or they become at least a large enough force that they could exert that their political control, and they revert to savagery. They've done it time and time again. It never fails. Now, this victim mentality that blacks have, that this victim mentality really is not a victim mentality. It's really a wolf pack reactionary mentality, where when a black person harms a white person, other black people either ignore it or they praise that black person. I've seen this 1,000 times. Oh, he got that off. Oh, he got that little white girl. He got that off. He did all right. Yeah, you know, and I've seen that 1,000 times in person, up close and personal with niggers, with Negroes. Well, I've been there. I've been on both sides of the bars in jails and prison for 25 years. Now,
I don't think there's any question but that they applaud one another just like Jews do. They're so similar to Jews.
But
so,
when a white person harms a black person, right away, all white people are offenders. Right? It's like a battlefield mentality. We should have that mentality, and we wouldn't have a black problem. We wouldn't have one if we had their mentality. Because when wherever you are, you see a white man fighting with one Negro, you don't see it if there's more than one Negro there. You won't see it. That there could be 15 white people and 30 blacks on the same city street, and a white guy and a black guy are fighting, the other whites are indifferent. The other blacks, they're on that white guy. I've seen.
Well, you know, if we had that mentality, Bill, then we would also be rather savage.
They don't care about the fair. No, what we have to do is have that mentality because it's a defensive mechanism. We have to realize that blacks have that mentality.
Yeah, that's it.
We have to respond likewise. When a white man and a black man fights.
Well, I think we have to realize.
The other Negroes don't care who's white or right or wrong. They only care that they're going to go and help that black guy out.
Well, we need to understand that they have that mentality and also that it's not going to change. I think this is part of the problem because
it's
I don't think white people to have that mentality, but they think that they're going to change these black people and they just keep believing that, oh, they really do have an axe to grind. They really have been mistreated. And, you know, after all these years, maybe, I don't hate always bringing up my age, but maybe, you know, when you were there from the start of this, not from slavery, but from, you know, the civil rights and so on in the 60s, and you thought that, oh, once you gave them these opportunities, then things were going to change. And after all these years, nothing has changed. It's worse. They get worse and worse and worse. So,
and it's going to get worse and worse and worse as we give them more and more political. I mean, they have it all now. They have, it's horrible now. But as they get more and more political power, we're going to have bigger and bigger problems.
And
we don't even understand the black mind. But when you, any action against, you know, blacks despise being put into American prisons, not because they're in prison, but because they're in prison under the white man's law.
Right.
And blacks don't, when they get caught raping, robbing, murdering, whatever they do, they never have, they never have remorse about their crimes. They only have remorse that they were caught. They're only upset and saddened that they were caught. Mm-hmm. That's all they care about. They don't care about their victims. They don't care about who they raped, who they robbed, who they killed. That they only feel bad because they were caught. Now,
they blame a white rule for that. And like this new Black Panther Party, everything is about, you know, they just hate the whites, because all these black men are in prison and so on. They, like you say, they never, ever, ever can address what they've done and what their problems are. And that's what
they don't see those things as crimes.
Well, that's what these two black ministers that I mentioned, you know, they can see that. These two black ministers, there are some people who can, but that's why they want all these black people. They say the only salvation, the only hope for the blacks here in the United States is to become Christian and put themselves under, you know, the love of Jesus or the rule of Jesus or whatever they call it. And then they think, you know, that then they'll accept what they are because they don't excuse black. They say black is not so good. They say black people are not truthful. Black people won't face the truth about themselves. They know that blackness is not something that's great and wonderful.
Well, when the blacks, you know, blacks in very large numbers emigrated from the deep south into the northeast in the 1950s and 60s, and they were supposedly all, I hate to call them Christians because they can't be, but they were supposedly all Christians. They were all Baptists and evangelicals and Methodists, and they moved up to the northeast and that they were given welfare and they were handed their livelihoods on a silver platter. They were given jobs simply because they were black. They were given high paid manufacturing jobs. And two generations later, the cities of the Northeast were destroyed.
Yeah. Well, I agree.
They were supposedly all Christians.
Yeah. That's right.
Savage.
No, I agree. These ministers are saying that, but I agree with you that that's not, nothing's going to change these people. And that's why we can't live with them. For right before, you know, you're going to have to go. Too bad you're going to have to go. You could stay, but I know you say you have, you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you didn't want to go more than into the next hour. But the stand your ground laws, they're really going after that along with the gun control. And do you think that the states that have that will hold firm on that and that will all die down?
Well, the stand your ground laws were laws designed so that whites can still defend themselves against blacks and other savage beasts like mestizos. The stand your ground laws, they're righteous laws which were designed so that whites could defend themselves and have a basis for doing so. There are states in the Northeast that if you shoot somebody in your own home, you're guilty. You're guilty. If you can't prove that your life was in immediate danger, you're guilty. And you could go to prison. And in England, it's like that. In England, you can't defend yourself in your own home. You defend yourself in your own home. That there was a case a couple of years ago, a man shot black home intruders in his own home, and he was put into prison.
Yeah, well, so that's what I mean. Stand your ground is very, very necessary. We have to be able to defend ourselves. They want us to not be able to defend ourselves against them.
What the Negroes want is a right to be the savage beast that they are in our society. That's what they want. They're not going to be happy until they have that right.
Right. Well, so it's going to take a lot of resistance, and it doesn't look good, like we were talking about, when the white people want to watch all these black sports people and watch all their movies and think of them as the people that they're presenting themselves as being, which they're not. Well, we're about ready for our break here, 10 seconds. So, Bill Fink, thanks very much for being on. And if you decide to stay on, we'll see you on the other side otherwise.
I really wish I could, Carolyn, but I really...
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bill. We'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starb. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starb. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. Arbeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allem entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on July 22nd, 2013. Bill is not here now. He did have to go, and Bill Fink was on with me the first hour. I really enjoyed that. I always like to be on a program with Bill. He is a very strong-minded, he expresses himself very strongly and clearly. In a way that, much better than I do, and I really like it too. I never disagree. There's really nothing I disagree with Bill Fink about. And never have in along those lines. I don't like to, I'm just not interested in going the Bible route about some of these things, but that's the only thing. But his final conclusions and outcome and so on, I agree with altogether. So. There we have it. We have a problem, you know. We have a real problem, we white people, in clearing ourselves from feelings of guilt or feelings of responsibility that are constantly put on us by these people who want to do this to us, you know, who want to make us responsible for their own failings and their own inabilities. And it's both the Jews and the Negroes and the gypsies too. The gypsies don't go about this in such a way, but the society makes you feel like you have to do things for these people. And I'm not going to be talking about them tonight, but, there's another group that I find, often difficult, and I wish it wasn't that way. I don't like to bring it up along, in the same, category as Negroes and Jews. But, you know, the Polish people seem to have a problem with overestimation of themselves or are wanting to blame other people for what they have not been able to accomplish or to take credit for what they haven't accomplished, even though they've accomplished a great deal. And they just seem to have kind of a problem, some of them, with honesty. They're very nationalistic, and they're very, they have a very high opinion of themselves, or they try to, and they have always had a hard time getting along with their neighbors, geographically. That's a fact too. They're not particularly popular in that area of Eastern Europe, and they have a lot of people surrounding them, other nations surrounding them, and they have trouble with all of them. But there's a lot of, you know, that doesn't mean I'm not here to disparage Poles, but I am going to talk about one Polish person, and that is Jan Karski. That came up on Saturday with Bradley Smith, and I have been interested in Karski in the past, and I researched him in the past, and I never got around to writing anything about him. Of course, mostly it's things have been written, so I don't really need to. But I would like to talk about this a little bit because it bears on some things that are going on right now. And the thing about Karski is he may be Jewish. He may be what's called a Polish Jew. He was a Polish Catholic. But Carlos Porter, who I'm going to be quoting some tonight, Carlos Porter, the revisionist and historical and Holocaust revisionist, has said in his on his page about Karski's book that he thinks he believes that Karski is Jewish, even and it kind of, you know, from the past, you know, that they were Jews who converted to Catholicism and so on. Now, I don't have any evidence of that, so I can't say that. But so maybe I'm talking still not so much about Polish traits, but about Jewish traits. And there are awful lot. There used to be an awful lot of Jews in Poland. You know, it was like 10% of the population. Now, I was surprised to find out in that reading about the Polish ban that the Polish legislature voted in. Very good of them. I was really pleased to see that they did that. They voted to uphold this ban on kosher slaughtering of animals for meat products. That's under attack, of course. I don't have any new information on that tonight. But what was I? I don't know how I got onto that. Oh, yeah, all the Jews. And it said that there was only 6,000 Jews in Poland now. I couldn't believe it. Oh, that's amazing. Only 6,000 Jews in a country of quite a few millions. You know, how many millions? I don't know. I didn't check on that. 10, 12, 15? I don't know. That's not very much. So the Jews really are not in Poland anymore. But they were big time. There are more Jews in Poland than any place else except Russia, which is so huge. But and Polish and Russian Jews are kind of they were kind of all from the same background, same genetics of Jews. But so this may, you know, have infected or had an influence on Poland. I don't know. I kind of probably said too much already. But let's go into this Jan Karski situation. This came up because, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about that, the Jan Karski Institute, which is what's really interesting to me now. What this thing really is and what it does, and how it's an over, you know, it's all this stuff with the Holocaust. It's a big overdone production with very little behind it, and looks better, bigger and better than what it really is. So now Bradley Smith has taken on this on as kind of a project, and I'm glad. I don't know. I did see what he's put out so far, but he and Jet Rucker have some plans for, I guess, mass mailings and whatever else to Georgetown University and to the students there, and they always include the faculty too, about Jan Karski and the truth about the man, because it's Georgetown University that hosts, you might say, this institute for Jan Karski. I'll get into that in a minute. What it started out with was that just in March there was this they had this special night, you know, panel thing and special tribute to Jan Karski, at some special deal they had there. And they got, Zbigniew Brzezinski to attend there. And because he's a famous Polish person, everybody knows who he is. He was an advisor to Jimmy Carter, and has been, you know, an important voice in foreign relations, foreign affairs, and so on, all along. He's Polish, and then there was the Polish ambassador, maybe the Polish ambassador to the United States. He was there. He was the other one. And then there was two Jews, Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, and a Jewish chaplain called Harold S. White. And they made a big deal out of this. And because what is happening here is that, the Georgetown University Press is republishing Jan Karski's 1944 book, Secret Story of a Secret State. And the book, according to them, documents Karski's work in the Polish underground beginning in 1939. So Karski is a, that's not his, that's the name he took. His name was Kozielewski. I have to go all over the place to find it. His real name. I'm not going to look for it, but it's a longer Polish name. And when he, at some point, he shortened it to Karski, I think when he was supposedly doing his undercover work. Basically, as I said on Saturday, he's a big liar, which is partly what makes me, you know, adds to my feeling about that Poles, you know, are not that careful about the truth. But it's, you know, I'm sure a lot of them are, but they just have this, they do have a reputation of going, telling lots of lies about what happened to Poles during, under the National Socialists and during World War II, and exaggerating everything and making themselves just as bad as Jews do, to make themselves the victims of what happened. And they doubled the amount of Poles that were killed. Supposedly there's 3,000, but they turned it into 6,000. And they say that, I mean million, 3 million, 6 million. And they say that 3 million Polish Jews were murdered. And they go all out joining with the Jews and Israel, too, on this kind of business. In upholding all of this, because Holocaust is big business. Well, there's several things. It's very important to Poland because they can present themselves as victims who need who get special compensation and special pass and things. You know, when you can say you suffered at the hands of this and that party or group or nation, then you can, you know, they owe you, and Poles are real good at playing on that. And then they also have all the Holocaust memorials there, and it brings in a lot of tourism, and it makes them, you know, gives them something to be important about too. So that's they don't want to lose that. So, I'm gonna, just to give the story of Karski, to start out, he is called a devout Catholic, and he, it's said that he was twice smuggled into the Warsaw Ghetto, during the 42, 43, and he entered, or 41, 42, he entered the Nazis, well, this is all not true. He entered a transit camp disguised as a guard. He may have done that, and he witnessed horrors of the Holocaust. See, the way they put that, they say it's kind of generalized. You know, he witnessed firsthand the horrors of the Holocaust. They don't say exactly always what he was witnessing and where he was witnessing it, but they just put it that way, horrors of the Holocaust, and everybody just accepts that. Uses their imagination and fills that in as to what that's supposed to be. But I think I'm going to go to, I don't know where I got this thing. Oh, this is from that Georgetown University thing. Okay, let me move on here. After the war, Karski was in the United States telling, he had already gone to the United States in 1943, and he had talked to a lot of high-level people and given his story, and mostly he was not believed. I don't know. I can't find my link. I think I was supposed to go find this page before I started the program, but I didn't, and I'm trying to find my Carlos page, but I don't have the, here it is. Okay, let me go there. Sorry about that, folks. All right. He supposedly was believed. The question is, was he believed? Was he not believed? But here's the story. You know, he wrote this book, and it came out in 1944, and before, you know, the end of the war. And the story that he told was basically that what he witnessed as the what he called the Holocaust was Jews being sent from Poland in rail cars, packed in there, to where they were dying inside there. And then there was quicklime on all the surfaces of the rail cars so that they were killed in the rail cars. We're talking about many rail cars let's see if I can find a short version of this. Many rail cars that were, I'm going to give the story of Karski first. Then I'll talk about Georgetown University. And supposedly they ended up at Belzec. That's what he said. But it was shown that he had that wrong, that, he was at a different place and he didn't see what happened at Belzec. And, there's just so many things wrong with his story. And one of the main things is that he never mentioned gas chambers. Now, Carlos Porter has a whole page at www.cwporter.com/karski.htm on this. And he writes that Karski wrote in his book, and this book was sold by the World Jewish Congress too in 1944, and that the Germans were exterminating Jews in trains full of quicklime. There was no mention of any other method of mass killing, and there was no detail, no mention of gas chambers anywhere in the book. Like Elie Wiesel, he talks about all kinds of terrible things being done to the Jews, but not about gas chambers. And he was there in, supposedly in Auschwitz, and doesn't speak about gas chambers. Now, Jan Karski, I guess I better go back where I was to give this short version of what he supposedly, did. Okay. He joined the Polish underground beginning in 1939. Okay, he wasn't using the name Karski then. He had a longer name starting with K. And there he was working for the Polish underground and as a Catholic. And he was twice smuggled into the Warsaw Ghetto. I already said that to you. And he entered the Nazis' Itzbika transit camp, disguised as a guard, and he witnessed firsthand the horrors of the Holocaust. I said that. Okay, and there's not much more detail about what he did as an undercover person, but they've made a big deal out of it since, that he was just so brave, and he just risked his life, and he went back and forth, and he was also an envoy to he was in touch with the Polish government in England, in London, and he was an envoy there. He carried some microfilm, he carried some important documents and so on, and then he met with the people there in London, the Polish government in exile mainly, but also Anthony Eden and some others. He told this story to all these people, and then he was sent back, and he did some more work in Poland. And then he got out of there, and he was sent to the United States, or he got to the United States in 43, I think it was, and he was talking to high-level people there, including President Roosevelt. And there's this question, as I said, about who believed him. Now they want to say that he was the first one to tell about the Holocaust, and he reported all this information, and people believed him. But some people didn't believe him, but, you know, nobody did anything about it. So I say nobody believed him, really. They wanted to hear what he had to say. That's true. They absolutely wanted to hear, and they were interested in what he had to say. But they didn't act on any of it. So I would say basically they didn't believe it. But here's what he, and now his book has, as I said, has just been reprinted by, the Georgetown Press, and, actually just came out. Wait a minute. Okay. Well, I'll get to that. Let me tell you what he wrote about what happened. And I'm going to read this directly from Carlos Porter's site. He's saying how, I don't know if it says exactly where the heck he is, but he's somewhere in Poland, and he's observing while he calls them the Nazis, of course, but he's observing these SS, he calls them the SS, ordering Jews, putting Jews into these train cars. And he says, and shooting them, you know, they're just because they want to, you know. The two policemen, he says, echoed, one guy was calling out, order, order. Two policemen echoed him hoarsely, firing straight into the faces of the Jews, running to the trains. Impelled and controlled by this ring of fire, they filled the two cars quickly. And now came the most horrible episode of them all, that he says that he was warned that if he lived to be 100, he would never forget some of the things he was going to see when they sent him where he was going to go so he could observe this. And he says that they did not exaggerate. He says the military rule stipulates that a freight car can carry 8 horses or 40 soldiers, but they decide, he says the Germans had decided, had ordered that, he means the higher ups had ordered that 120 to 130 Jews had to enter each car, even though they were built for 40. And alternately swinging and firing with their rifles, the policemen, now they're police, they're German police, or they might be, Polish or Hungarian police or Ukrainian police who are there. It was never Polish police because the Poles, declared war on Germany, joined the Allies, and they were occupied. They never joined with the Germans, none of them there. So any forces that were there were not Polish. The policemen were forcing still more people into the two cars, which were already overfull. The shots continued to ring out in the rear, and the driven mob surged forward, exerting an irresistible pressure against those nearest the train. These unfortunates, crazed by what they had been through, scourged by the policemen and shoved forward by the milling mob, began to climb on the heads and shoulders of those in the trains. These were helpless since they had the weight of the entire advancing throng against them. According to Jan Karski, he was witnessing these Germans just brutally forcing 120 Jews or 130 Jews into each of these rail cars and firing shots at them. And they were scared to death and, you know, trampling one another and so on, which is, and then he says, let me catch that. He said, they were crazed by what they were going through and so on. And he goes on and on about that. See, they like to go on and on about the brutality, but when it comes to the facts of, you know, what, how this could really be happening and where they were and so on, then that's just sloughed over because it's all basically made up. And then, you know, he says they're stepping on one another and breaking bones and so on. He says, after the cars had already been filled beyond normal capacity, more than another score, that is 20 or more people, or 15 or something people were pushed in. And so then that Carlos says that would be 140 to 150 people per rail car. Then the policeman slammed the doors across the hastily withdrawn limbs that still protruded and pushed the iron bars in place. The two cars were now crammed to bursting with tightly packed human flesh, completely hermetically filled. And Carlos says at this rate they'd be dead in a matter of minutes anyway, so who needs the rest of this whole complicated procedure? But the story goes on, and Karski writes, all this while the entire camp had reverberated with a tremendous volume of sound, in which the hideous groans and screams mingled weirdly with shouts, curses, and bellowed commands. I don't even know what camp he is at, but they say he was probably, I'll get to that. Nor was this all. I know that many people will not believe me, will think I exaggerate or invent, but I saw it, and it is not exaggerated or invented. I have no other proofs, no photographs. All I can say is that I saw it and that it is the truth. Now, this is important because this is what we find so many of these survivors or witnesses saying. They say, I saw this. Even you find these little known survivors who, you know, nobody's heard of, but they go around to these schools and community centers and so on, and they tell their story, and they all say, and for some reason, the people who are listening to them believe them when they say, I know it sounds crazy, I know it's hard to believe, but I saw it. It really did happen. You know, you can believe me, and people believe them. But it's always like that. I mean, this is so common in these books and so on that they have no proof, no photographs, no nothing, but they want you to believe what they're saying. And why do we do it? Well, I just think that we have a desire to believe this stuff. We have a desire to believe people when they stand up in front of us and speak and so on. We, you know, most honest people who don't lie, for the most, you know, on big things, wouldn't do it, or they don't think they would do it, but they, you know, they're not in this situation where they're a member of a nation or a group or something that, you know, that has gone through something very big, like the Poles went through being defeated by the Germans when they thought that they were in, you know, had a good thing going there with the English and the French, and that they were going to come to their aid, and between the three of them, they were going to defeat Germany. And they were, and the Poles were going to march into Berlin and take over, because the Poles had been, you know, had seen Germans as the enemy, off and on, or mostly on, but for many, many, many years. And, you know, they like to think that I won't go into all that. Okay. So these people feel a need, like Karski, they excuse their lies, and they might even, you know, I don't know, but they make up stories, and they might even think, well, it could have happened this way, or it might have happened this way, or terrible things happened. And so they just say this stuff, and they are probably, he was probably kind of convincing, maybe, because if he had really convinced himself of it. But yet again, I say that I don't think that he convinced people, at the time, but they were certainly courteous to him, and he, because he was on the Allies side, and he was talking to all the Allies and all these Poles, who were in the government, you know, the government in exile and so on. So everybody was treating him well. Anyway, to go on with his story, because now this is what he's telling people that he saw, and he doesn't have any proof, but they should believe it. He says the floors of the car, the rail car, had been covered with a thick white powder. It was quicklime. Quicklime is simply unslaked lime or calcium oxide that has been dehydrated. Anyone who has seen cement being mixed knows what occurs when water is poured on lime. The mixture bubbles and steams as the powder combines with the water, generating a large amount of heat. And here Carlos Porter says, see this note that he wrote below, but he has written that quicklime is what is used, and it's true, in people who have outhouses or used to have outhouses. They would throw this quicklime, somebody would, usually the woman of the house, would go out there and maybe every morning and throw all this quicklime down there, and it covered up the smell and it made it decompose without stinking so much and did a lot of good. But he says that you could just do it with a hand, just the bare hand. You could just take handfuls of quicklime with your bare hand and throw it down into these holes, and that outhouse holes, and that people did it all the time. You know, it didn't hurt you any. But Karski is saying here, I don't know, there might be a difference, but he says, that if you mix it, if it's mixed with water, it'll bubble and steam and, create a lot of heat. Then Karski says, here, the lime served a double purpose in the Nazi economy of brutality. The moist flesh coming in contact with the lime is rapidly dehydrated and burned. The occupants of the cars would be literally burned to death before long, the flesh eaten from their bones. Thus the Jews would die in agony, fulfilling the promise Himmler had issued in accord with the will of the Führer in Warsaw in 1942. Well, I don't know, you know, he's referring to something there that isn't what he says it is, because there was, you know, that somehow Himmler made a promise to Hitler to make all the Jews die in agony in 1942. Then he goes on to say, secondly, the lime would prevent decomposing bodies from spreading disease. It was efficient and inexpensive, a perfectly chosen agent for their purposes. It took 3 hours to fill up the entire train by repetitions of this procedure. So he watched his 3 hours. They put these people in these train cars this way. And then he says it was twilight when the 46, I counted them, cars were packed. That's Karski saying that. And Carlos Porter figures it out, and he says 46 cars with 140 people in each adds up to 6,440 people. And Karski writes, from one end to the other. Now, this sounds like Elie Wiesel. It's a lot of other of these witnesses, Jewish witness writers. From one end to the other, the train with its quivering cargo of flesh seemed to throb, vibrate, rock, and jump as if bewitched. There would be a strangely uniform momentary lull, and then again the train would begin to moan and sob, wail, and howl. Inside the camp, a few score dead bodies remained, and a few in the final throes of death. German policemen walked around at leisure with smoking guns, pumping bullets into anything that by a moan or motion betrayed an excess of vitality. Soon, soon not a single one was left alive. In the now quiet camp, the only sounds were the inhuman screams that were echoes from the moving train. Then these too ceased. All that was now left was the stench of excrement and rotting straw, and a queer, sickening, acidulous odor, which I thought may have come from the quantities of blood that had been let and with which the ground was stained. As I listened to the dwindling outcries from the train, I thought of the destination toward which it was speeding. My informants had minutely described the entire journey. The train would travel about 80 miles and finally come to a halt in an empty, barren field. So he was there, left behind where the train had been, and then his informants had told him what was going to happen from there on. He says, when the train came to a halt in this empty field, nothing at all would happen. The train would stand stock still, patiently waiting while death penetrated into every corner of its interior. This would take from 2 to 4 days. When quicklime, asphyxiation, and injuries had silenced every outcry, a group of men would appear. They would be young, strong Jews assigned to the task of cleaning out these cars until their own turn to be in them should arrive. You know that story that all the people who worked handling these dead Jews were going to be killed in turn, so they couldn't testify to anything. Under a strong guard, they would unseal the cars and expel the heaps of decomposing bodies. The mounds of flesh that they had piled up would then be burned and the remnants buried in a single huge hole. And Carlos Porter reminds us that this is 6,440 people they have to deal with and burn and bury in this single hole. And Karski goes on writing, the cleaning, burning, and burial would consume 1 or 2 full days. The entire process of disposal would take then from 3 to 6 days. So the whole process here, he says, takes from 3 to 6 days. And, of course, Porter here asks a bunch of questions about that's not possible. But see, this is a part of the whole Holocaust story of how they destroyed all these, so many people. This is only 6,440. So that's not very many people taken from the entire 6 million, is it, that they had to deal with? And then Karski says, during this period of 3 to 6 days where these people were being burned and buried, the camp would have recruited new victims, the camp that they came from, I guess. And then the train would return and the whole cycle would be repeated from the beginning. Porter says for 50 years, Karski never repudiated this lie and even, compounded it with another lie that he, quote, attempted to warn the world of the Holocaust but was not believed. Porter says that he was believed, but a lot of the people that he mentions that he thinks he was believed by were Poles. So the Poles were believing it. Various Poles in the ex-government in exile. And he mentions that Anthony Eden told Karski, I am honored to have met you. But that doesn't mean he believes him. He believed him. And a lot of them may have acted like they believed him, but they didn't really, because nothing was done. This was in, I'm having trouble getting all the dates right. But anyway, I'm going to go to, where's my notes? I have to recover my notes. I'm sorry about that, folks. I thought I had everything here, but I don't, so I have to go there and get that. Okay. Take me a minute here. I have to bring up Open Office. Let me see if I should close something. Let me look in my email. See if I have any emails from anybody. Well, here's my recovery. Okay, things are moving along well. Recovery successfully recovered. Here it comes. It's not what I want, though. Here it is. I'll get rid of this page. Now I have to narrow it. Okay. Now, No, I don't have anything in email. I can get rid of that. I don't know what causes this thing, but I just think it's crummy Windows. I hate Windows, but I'm stuck with it because I don't know how to use anything else. All right, let me get back down now because I do want to use the last not even 15 minutes left to talk about this Karski Educational Foundation. Okay, it was only established in May 2011. It's brand new. And it came from, I went and looked at it, and I was surprised at what I found because I thought it would have been something older. And there was a group that formed, all Poles, really, a bunch of Polish people. They formed to place Karski's name in nomination for the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which he won. I don't have that exact date when it was. It wasn't too long ago. He's one of the recent winners of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It's the United States thing. Like with the Nobel Prize, people have to lobby for you and put your name up and so on. Well, anyway, they were successful, and he won. He did get the medal. And then now, he's got something to go by. Oh, he's the winner of the United States Medal of Freedom. Big deal. I can imagine all the people who have won that who are scum of the earth. But so on this, and then after that, they started this group that had, maybe it wasn't so long ago. I mean, maybe it was longer ago than I'm saying. Maybe it wasn't just real recently. But this group, that got him the nomination and got him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. They then established this Jan Karski Educational Foundation at Georgetown University, but Georgetown University doesn't have all that much to do with it. These things that you see they give you an impression that is not quite true. So it just started, like I said, in 2011, and it's part of the School of Foreign Services program for Jewish civilization. That's what it is. And the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown is what you'd call the international studies curriculum. It's a school of its own, as they have at universities. And then within this school, international studies school, they have this thing called Program for Jewish Civilization, which from what I can see is just another Jewish studies program. They don't call it the Jewish studies program. They call it something else, Program for Jewish Civilization. But, it's run by Jews, and Jews are all studying all about Jews and so on. And so it's there in that program that you find the Jan Karski Institute for Holocaust Education. They call it, it's called by several things. It's called a Karski Educational Foundation. But officially, it seems to be only Holocaust education. Jan Karski Institute for Holocaust Education. And so in July 18th, I looked on their website there, and they had an event on July 18th, just a couple days ago. And they had high school educators coming to the campus to learn more about the Holocaust and genocide studies, and to earn a Georgetown certificate named in honor of the of Jan Karski, who is identified as a professor from their university who brought the first reports to the world about the World War II tragedy, which is the tragedy of the murder of the Jews or the tragedy of the Holocaust and so on. And I don't have too much time, of course, so I can get this in. The mission statement on this Karski Institute is that they're promoting his book. And they got the Georgetown University to their press, all these universities publish books, and they republished this book, which is called, the new one. It's the same book, but it's called, I'll come up to it, I guess. The main title of it is Story of a Secret State. And the first time he wrote it, he called it Report of a Spy or something like that. Story of a Secret State. And this one is called something else. The first part of it is a little bit changed to make it, I guess, sell better. But, so their mission is to promote his book and also to advance interfaith cooperation and exchange, especially between Catholics and Jews, the Catholic and Jewish communities. So supposedly he was a Catholic who worked so hard for the Jews. And so, you know, he's one of the righteous. He's on the Yad Vashem, you know, righteous Gentiles or something like that. And of course, we know that when these people want to bring about cooperation between Catholics and Jews, what they want is the Catholics to go along with what the Jews want, and not at all for Jews to ever go along with what Catholics might want. So that's the whole point there. And I am glad that Carlos Porter says that he believes that Karski is a Jew, because even though he's not officially Jewish, he could very, very well be, and he certainly has taken a huge interest in the Jewish well-being and so on, the Jewish community. And the third part of the mission statement is educating Americans about Polish history, especially, particularly, Poland's contributions to the Allied effort in World War II. So you see, it's all this. The people behind this are not really Jews. They're really Poles. There's Jews. Of course, Jews are all for it, and they have some Jewish support, but most of the support is Polish, and it's about promoting Polish history and Poland's version of World War II, and using this man, Karski, as one of the few people they can use as a big hero. They've turned him into a hero. I said on the website there, they call him humanity's hero. Oh, no. What do they call him? Where was that? Oh, well, I'm not going to look for it now. Something about that, humanity's hero, hero of humanity or something. And the board of directors is made up of 8 people with Polish names, all very much Polish-looking Polish names. I didn't notice any. There's nobody with just a Jewish name there. And the benefactors, they have a whole list of benefactors. And there's a bunch of them, but they just have regular names. Some names are Polish. Some names are Jewish. Some names don't look like any of that. So I don't know how important these are. They're just ordinary names. I don't know how important these benefactors are, why they allow their name to be there. But they are probably people who've been helpful and maybe donated money. Now then they have partners, and the partners are important, I think. And the first partner, and what you see all over that website, is the Polish History Museum. The main force behind this is the Polish History Museum, in my estimation. That's the first partner listed, and their little logo is all over the website. So, and then after that, the Polish Consulate in New York City, the Polish Embassy in Washington, D.C., then the American Jewish Committee. That's the only definitely Jewish thing that's there, but that's the biggest. The American Jewish Committee is, this is basically an American-U.S. deal here. They're the biggest organization in the United States for Jews, I think, still. And the National Endowment for the Humanities. So they get money from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Whenever you're in the, you're in the politically correct area of things, you can get all kinds of money from government organizations, which people like us couldn't get. Then there's Georgetown University, then Polish Institute of Arts and Sciences, then something called the Kosciuszko Foundation, which is Polish, then the Polish American Committee, Polish Americans Librarians Association, Polish American Association, and then a nonprofit organization founded by Slavomir Grunberg to research, distribute, and produce documentary films, which has made films, some of the documentary films about Karski. So that's that. And what else did I have here? Carlos, the thing about, where is this? Okay. From Wikipedia. He has a big Wikipedia page, and they, you know, it's all promoting him big time and everything. But the one thing that is that at the time that he wrote this book, he thought, or he says he thought, that that the what he had visited was the Belzec death camp. He thought he was at the Belzec death camp, and that's what he wrote about and told and so on. But later they realized that he was not there, and that he was probably at a sorting and transit point in the town of Izbica Lubilska, which was located midway between Lublin and Belzec. So later, historians said this was the case, and he admitted or agreed that probably he wasn't at Belzec after all. But he identified where he was as the Belzec death camp. And he had to know at the time, I would say, that... it says there's a footnote on his page. It says that he identified camp as Belzec death camp, even though he knew at the time that the camp could not have been in Belzec. So he lied knowingly, and it's known now that he lied about that. And, of course, he lied about the whole thing that happened, because nothing like that ever took place. But it's now accepted that he wasn't in Belzec, but at this Lubelska sorting camp. And he made up this crazy story about what was happening there. Well, ladies and gentlemen, my time is up. At least I got to say a little bit about this. I'm sorry, it didn't sound to me like I was very well organized here. But I thought I was. I have some more things I could say, but I've got enough of it in. I want to thank you very much for listening tonight, and sorry about the problems with going off the air. But on Saturday, I'm going to have Andre Englund on my program. Sure, you're tuning in, and also international. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.